Hey, what's going on, people? We back. This is Shock Therapy with your boy. I'm just saying, we got a special guest in the studio today. I wanted to say something else, but I'm so honored. I guess I'm a little shaken, a little smitten, whatnot. We have I call him legendary, and he told me this morning, could I please not call him Mr. Nicholas? So we have Tony. Mr. Tony, what is it? Edwin Tony Nicholson? Anthony Nicholson? Nicholas?
All of that is fine.
Okay. I just want to make sure. Because I was messing up. He said, could you just call me? I'm like, I'll call you Tony. What's going on?
Hey, man. I'm just glad to be here. Glad you asked me to come down and, you know, glad to do what I can do, man.
I appreciate it. So what's, let everybody know exactly what is it that you do.
Well, on a day-to-day basis, I make records. I'm a songwriter. I produce. I'm on a lot of the weekends. I still play out. I still work with the OJs, occasionally with Johnny Gill. So I'm still a touring musician, but mostly I'm in the studio writing. I'm always looking for new folks to collab with and to get down with. It's just because that keeps it fresh. So I'm always looking. I said it, yes. If you are a songwriter or a musician, look me up. I'm always looking for somebody new to do my thing.
That is awesome. I also, I fiddle with the little production a little bit. I'm okay. I'm not on your level, but I'm okay. So that's good to know. That's personally for me.
Well, you know what? Yeah. I gotta say this before you go any farther. There are no levels.
Oh, okay, cool.
And the reason why I say that is because I've known guys that do way more than me. Mm-hmm. That are bagging groceries at Giant Eagle.
Wow.
And I know guys that do less than me that are, you know, charging $200,000 a song. So there are no levels.
Wow.
I mean, you're one job away from somebody hiring you to make a record, and that's maybe the only thing that separates you from me. So I was the same guy before I got the first project.
Right.
You know, so there are no levels as far as I'm concerned from a musical standpoint. Mm-hmm. You know, we're peers.
That's dope.
So, you know, I don't look at it that way. I've been lucky enough to be shown favor. And when you get shown favor, things will happen in your life, but it's not due to anything I did.
Right.
So how can I say I'm on a different level?
Respect. That's respect, folks. Now, you said something that maybe people didn't catch. You said favor. What do you mean by favor? What type of favor are you talking about?
Well, I mean, I'm showing favor by God. I mean, that's what it is. I can't think that I would be fooled to think that the successes that I've had would do to anything I ever did.
Wow.
I would be a fool to think that. And that's the reason why I don't look at there being any levels, because what makes me greater than you?
Right.
Nothing.
Right.
Everything
right.
that I've done in my life. I've been fortunate enough. I've had music on the charts every single year for the last 20 years.
That is dope.
Now, actually, 22 years since 92. Now, what have I ever done to make that happen? That's favor.
Wow. You say 22 years?
Yes, sir.
Wow. You got me with that one. That's amazing. That is amazing. Wow. So tell me, we know a little bit about what you do. You told us you're a producer. Give me a couple names of people that you work with. And I guess it's a two-part question. People you work with and some of the most interesting people you work with to you.
Wow. Let's see. Just if I was going to go random, I would say that I've worked with, obviously, I have a huge body of work with Gerald Levert.
Right.
So, you know, the folks that he's associated with, I did a bunch of work with early on with, like, the Rude Boys, the Men at Large's.
Okay.
One of the girls, a group called Drama from Cleveland, Mickey Howard.
Mickey,
we've
yeah.
done Patti LaBelle. We did Barry White, the OJs, the Backstreet Boys, Joe.
Cool.
I can't remember them all, but it's been a lot.
That's a good
actually,
thing.
Currently, thank you. I'm currently working with a girl named LaToya London. I'm making a record on her now. I don't know if you may remember her from the third season of American Idol.
Yeah.
She was on with Fantasia.
Yeah.
And Jennifer Hudson.
Yeah.
Great singer. I'm in the midst of working on a record for her right now.
So. Wow.
It doesn't stop.
I see.
It's been moving.
Wow, that's cool. Now let me ask you a question. You said you've been doing this for how long now?
I've been doing it my whole life, but whole I've life? Had records on the charts probably, well, started in 92, and I've had something on the radio every year.
Every year. Okay, now with that, and I know you are a born-again Christian, how was the transition? First of all, what age were you when you got saved? I guess the other part of the question is, did it ever hinder you in making secular music?
Well, I got baptized when I was 8. My grandfather baptized me. He was a minister, obviously.
Okay.
Pastor. So I've been in the church my entire life. What I would say is that it didn't really hinder me. And the reason it didn't hinder me is because my standard has always been, if there's nothing wrong with me saying something, then there's nothing wrong with me singing it.
Okay.
But if there's something wrong with me singing it, then I shouldn't be saying it.
Right.
And so I try to only sing about and write songs about the things that I would say. And if my speech is governed by what I know is right and what is wrong and what the book says do and don't do,
right,
then there's only certain things I'm going to write songs about.
Right.
And so there's a lot of subject matter out there that I don't fool with. And I think that should be more the determining factor than whether it's secular or not, because a lot of times there's no point in preaching to the choir. I mean, you got to go out in the world and you got to touch the folks that might not be in the choir.
Exactly.
So if you are a living example, then that does way more good than you saying, well, I'm not going to touch this music because I'm so-and-so and so-and-so.
I agree.
There's no good in that. So I tend to try to, there have been plenty of acts that I've not worked with because I couldn't really deal with what they stood for, or I couldn't do the kind of music that they did or whatever. And so I think that's where I draw the line.
Good. That is amazing. That is dope. Wow. You heard it here, folks. I know a lot of people were wondering about that. I know I've been asked that question about, you know, when I've asked producers in the past who've done work on both sides, you know, how do you decipher between the two? Does it bother you? Does it, you know, are you get backlash from it? Are people kind of judgmental on you because you still do music and R&B and more so not gospel? So I'm glad you answered that question, because I want people to understand how important it is to have that standard, because like you said, it's between you and God and your relationship and what's right, you know, by you reading the book and what you got from reading the Bible and whatnot. So that's awesome. I'm really impressed by that. My next question is this, and I've been thinking about this for the past 2 weeks since I found out I was going to have you on the show. So I got to ask this. What would you tell somebody that wanted to get into music?
It's interesting that you would ask that, because I'm actually having discussions right now with my son, who's 13, and he kind of thinks that he wants to get into music, but I don't necessarily know that he's at a point where he's made up his mind yet.
Okay.
What I would say is that if you're going to do it, the first thing you have to do is take it seriously. Treat it like a business, because this is a business. You have to learn everything about the business side of what you're going to be doing.
Right.
And you have to go to work every day. If you're a songwriter, you need to go to work every single day and write. I'll tell you something that happened to me. I used to live in Columbus.
Okay.
And when I was in Columbus, I had a 9-to-5 job. So I was working there all day. I had a recording studio. At night, I went to work in the studio, and I put 8 hours a day in at the studio at night.
Wow. Okay.
I'm writing all of these songs. I don't know why I'm doing it, but something in me kept saying, keep working, keep working.
Right.
Fast forward 3 years later,
uh-huh,
I meet Gerald Levert. Every single one of those songs I wrote got put out.
Wow.
Every one of them got put out. But when I was working, I didn't know I was going to do with them or you know, what was going to happen. In Columbus, I didn't know anybody. I didn't have any connections. I didn't know a soul down there.
Wow.
What happened is, one of the songs that I wrote, girl was writing with me, a girl named Carla Napper. She had a mutual friend who went to high school with the musical director for the Levert band at the time.
Okay.
So he heard the songs and wanted to hire me to play in the Levert band as a keyboardist. I didn't even own a keyboard at that time. I was a bass player.
Right.
Did not own a keyboard, but the song Casanova was their single, so it was really easy to play.
Right.
And so I became a keyboard player. And so Gerald and I hooked up when he decided he wanted to do a solo album because he didn't want it to sound like LaVert.
Right.
And so at the suggestion of his dad, Eddie, Gerald and I got together and every one of those songs that I wrote got used. So sometimes you don't know when your break is going to come, and when they and when something happens, now they want a whole lot of stuff from you very fast.
Right.
And so you have to be prepared.
Be prepared, right.
And so what I would say is treat it like a business and get up every single day and work at it. Don't just sit there and wait for something to happen. You get up and work, because when the door does open, you have to be ready.
That is interesting. That is so interesting. Wow, you got me with that one. It's funny you say that, because 8 years, maybe 8 or 9 years ago, I'm gonna say 10. I gotta say about, you know, it's been about 13 years. I bought a board. I was playing around with a group. We were having a little fun, and we got kind of serious, and we had a rap group, and it was kind of a faith-based group. And I remember we were writing to certain beats that this guy was doing, and I remember saying, I can't write to some of this stuff. Cause I kept hearing beats in my head, and I couldn't understand why I couldn't write. I couldn't write, but I kept hearing the beats. So I remember we had a little altercation where I told this guy, I said, yo, if you made the beat a certain way different, if you put these drums into it, maybe I can write to it. And I remember the conversation he told me. He said, when you want me to make a beat personally, the way that you want, you could pay me. And so my answer was, okay, fine. I'll make it myself. And from that point on, I would practice at the church. I would use their keyboard that they had. It was a Roland XP80. It was the first thing I started on, and I had fun with it. And I had to learn how to loop, which was kind of tricky at first. Doing that, I end up saving up some money, and I thank my sister for it. She gave me some extra money to get me my first board, which was a Roland X6. And so I've had this Roland X6 for about 12 years, 10 years. And I've been like making beats and I never really did anything with anybody except maybe one of my friends, but I just kept making these beats that I kept hearing. And I remember talking to my wife about it, and I was like, I don't know why I keep hearing all these beats. The game has changed so much. There's so many differential changes in what I'm like, but I keep hearing beats this way. And so it's good to hear what you're saying, because it encourages me. And I know it encourages a lot of other people who's writers, who singers, who maybe have done it longer than we have and worked just as hard and felt like, when am I going to get my time, or why am I, sometimes they question, so why am I doing this? So it's good to hear that, like you said, you don't know what God has in plan for you, because like I said, we have favor on our life, and it just shows that at any given time, like you said, one record or one person away from actually getting our big break.
Absolutely.
So that's dope. That is just amazing. Wow, you heard it here, folks. This is Shock Therapy with Mr. Tony. I'm gonna call him Tony from here on out, because he got on me about his last name. He said, I am not that old, dude. So Tony. So Tony, let's get into this is what I call the fun part of the show. You say you have a 13-year-old son. Any more kids?
I have a 5-year-old and I have an 18-year-old. And my 18-year-old is in college.
Cool. What college?
She's at Fordham University in New York.
Nice.
Straight A student. She's studying computer science, doing a thing. She also, she's a musician as well.
Cool.
She plays guitar. She likes alternative rock.
That is dope.
And the funny part about that is, of all of the folks that I've worked with, you know, she was on the road with, you know, Casey and JoJo back in the day. I have pictures with her, you know, with Howard Hewitt and with Patti LaBelle and all of these folks that, you know, she was sitting in my lap when I was working with the Backstreet Boys.
Right.
And none of that ever meant anything to her. I did a song with some guys from a group called Weezer. It was an alternative rock group.
Yeah.
She was like, now, Dad, you're getting somewhere. So,
hey.
So
that's funny,
you know,
man.
So, you know, she's like, well, did you get their autograph? And I said, well, actually, the guy asked for my autograph. She's like, stop lying, Dad.
Wow. That's amazing. Hey,
so,
that's amazing.
You know, everybody has what they think is the pinnacle. So
yeah.
she thought that
Weezer was the, know, yeah, yeah, was the greatest thing ever.
For her, that was what it was.
Oh, man,
now,
that's
my 13-year-old, he aspires to play guitar, great singing voice.
Okay.
And my 5-year-old plays drums. and it's actually pretty good.
So you got a real life band in your family.
Well, you know, yeah, we're spread out a little bit, but you know, my wife actually sings. She was, I used to live in Columbus, as I mentioned. She was in a teen group called Teen Dream back in the 80s. And, they had a song called Let's Get Busy. I was the musical director for the band.
Right.
We never dated back then, but, you know, so yeah, there is a kind of musical family. Son is really, really surprisingly kind of cool on the drums. He just picked it up
and never put it down.
Yeah, he just went with it, man. And, you know, he sings and does his thing. Actually has a decent singing voice as well at five.
Wow.
So, yeah, it's kind of a, you know, everybody aspires to be musical. The 5-year-old is not serious about anything.
Right, he's just having fun. Oh, really?
Singing is the only thing he's serious about. Everything else, he's a clown.
I understand that.
I asked him recently to tell me a bedtime story because I was telling him one and he wasn't making him go to sleep. So I said, you know, hey man, why don't you tell me a bedtime story? He said, okay, Dad, I got one for you. Once upon a time, there was an old man named Daddy. The end.
He got you. Like, they will
go to bed.
That's funny. That's so cool. That's cool. Let me ask you about, and I remember you when I was telling you, you said you had something to do with your son at school. How important is it for you to separate the time that you put in as far as musically with the time that you have for your family? And how do you do it?
That's a tough one. Luckily, like I said, my wife is, she started out in the business, so she understands.
That's good.
That doesn't mean she always likes it, but she understands.
Right.
But, sometimes I have to include them in things that I'm doing. If I have to go comp vocals, I might have to take my son with me and let him see what it is that I do so that he has a better appreciation for, you know, what's going on. But being parents, obviously, that's the most important job that we'll ever have.
Right.
You know, writing songs and making music is my passion, but being a parent, there is no more important job than that because we got to raise them up in the right way.
Exactly.
And if we don't, somebody else will raise them up. And they're not going to do the kind of job that we're going to be happy with.
No.
See, kids have a different situation than they did when I was a kid. Our kids have a lot of things pulling for their attention.
Exactly.
You know, and most of it is not necessarily positive. Yeah. So if you leave a void, something will fill that void. And I guarantee you it might not be what you would want it to be.
Exactly.
So, you know, we can't let the world raise our kids and then be mad at the outcome.
That's true.
So
that
is, you want them to be a certain way. You know, and my Bible teaches me that, you know, I'm going to be judged by my kids' kids. And so I need to make sure that my kids, at least I do my part.
Right. Right.
You know, and then after that, I can leave it in the hands of the man. But I have to do the part that's been put on my heart.
That is awesome. That is awesome. Now, you said that sometimes your wife doesn't like it. How do you make time for her? Because that's a tricky situation. And I've always thought if you have a wife and children, because you kind of have to give the wife her time and you have to give the kids their time and sometimes each individual kid their time. But I know more so with the wife. How does that work out with you and your household?
There's only one thing that gets me off the hook.
What's that?
She's busy too.
That's
the only thing. If it weren't for that,
right,
I would be in trouble every week.
Wow.
But she's busy too. She just actually became a controller at a company and she works 12-14 hours a day herself.
Wow.
And so that's the only thing that saves me.
Wow.
Is the fact that she's busy and she also understands what I have to do.
Right.
You know, she knows what it takes and between those two things, that's what saves me. Otherwise, I'd have to get a personal doghouse built.
And custom
get an
made
interior decorator,
custom,
you know. That's, that's what it would be, man.
I understand that is
yes, sir.
That's cool. So communication is very big with you two then.
Well, absolutely. I mean, you know, that's big in every relationship.
Exactly.
Communication, there is no relationship where communication isn't at the basis of it. And if it's not, you have an unhealthy relationship.
Yeah, I was about to say, you definitely do, because I was, like I said, being in the entertainment game, you know, we see a lot of fly-by-night marriages and fly-by-night divorces, and I'm like, what happened? You know, what's up with that? And it kind of looks bad because it becomes almost like a fad, like a thing to do, get married, get divorced. It's like it's not taken serious. So I'm glad to see that you take your marriage and your family serious, and that's something we encourage here at Culture Shock. We are definitely advocates about family, about men being in their place, loving your wives, even if you're doing a great job, striving to do an even better job than that, you know. So
absolutely,
that's cool. So how long have you been married?
Actually, only 7 years.
Oh, okay.
My 18 and 13 are from a previous relationship.
Okay.
And my son is with my wife.
Okay.
We've been friends for many a years, but we actually just started dating in 2005. As a matter of fact, the last place Gerald LaVert sang was at my wedding.
Really?
Yeah, he passed away a few days later.
Wow.
Yes, sir. We had just gotten back from South Africa.
Right. Remember, and he was sick and he was feeling uncertain.
Yep.
Wow.
Absolutely.
Wow, you know what? Let me ask you a question about that. I know working with him a long time, you guys got kind of close. Mm-hmm. How did you take it, and what did you get from your relationship with being around him so long for all those years?
Well, I would say in the earlier years, I really didn't allow us to be friends. And after a while, maybe I regretted that. I always kind of thought that sometimes when people become friends, they wind up taking the work situation for granted. And
right.
I never wanted to do that.
Right.
I never wanted to forget that I worked for him.
Right.
And so I think, you know, I allowed us, in much the same way that if you had a job right now, you would conduct yourself a certain way around your boss, and you would be not really wanting to let your hair down. You always want to keep that professional persona.
Right.
And I think maybe I took that to maybe farther than I should have.
Okay.
But we actually became friends when we had a quick break in the music and we didn't work together for a second.
Okay.
And that's when we actually became friends.
Cool.
Because we separately went through some of the same things together,
right,
some of the same challenges, and then got back together and said, you know what, man, we're better together than we are apart. And we became friends at that point. So a part of me wishes that I had let that happen sooner.
Right.
Because he was an imperfect person, but he was a great guy.
Right.
And, you know, we all have our shortcomings and idiosyncrasies and what have you. But he had a good spirit and he was a great dude, man. And he's sorely missed. I mean, and not even just by me. He was a one-man industry in this city.
Yeah, we know.
And that has not been replaced.
You're right. We were hoping that maybe somebody would step up, but like you said, sometimes you don't realize what you have until it's gone. And I think when I got a little glimpse of the public funeral that they had, or the remembrance show that they had here with Stevie Wonder and all those guys and his dad and his brother, you kind of seen it, because it was so many people that just, like I said, there were so many testimonies about the music and their one-on-one interactions with him when they met him, of just how gentle and how humble he was. He wasn't a funny dude. And I've known a couple of people who met him and said, yo, he's the farthest thing from funny.
Absolutely.
And so I appreciate that. That's good.
But Cleveland, I hate to cut you off. Cleveland does have a way of keeping you humble, though.
Who you telling? We know all about it.
And it was really, really funny that, you know, he would go to, you know, we went to South Africa and literally he was treated like Michael Jackson.
Really?
But then he could come to Cleveland and have an incident with the police and the police don't even know who he is in his own hometown.
That is funny. But that's how it is.
Yeah.
That is wild.
Absolutely.
But they always say that you can go outside your state and get all your love, but that's in the Bible though. Jesus go everywhere. Everybody knew him. Everybody, you know, they throwing praise, but his hometown is rejected. So it's like,
then I guess we can't complain.
No, not at all. I was about to say, we can't say nothing about that. That's wow. What was one of the lessons that you learned from him that maybe he taught you, or maybe something you got from watching him, or something that you keep with you to this day?
One of the things was a production value.
Okay.
And I'll tell you, I'll tell you what happened. We were working on, we were producing some songs on a guy named Keith Washington.
I remember Keith Washington.
Yeah, you know, we wrote this idea, and then, you know, we used to write songs very fast.
Right.
You know, I mean, like, you know, maybe 10, 15 minutes.
Oh, that's crazy.
You know, so he would come in and sing a hook and say, okay, now put some verses to that and a bridge, and I'll be back to sing in 10 minutes, 15 minutes, or whatever.
So, right.
And he expected it to be done. So a lot of times, you know, some of the stuff was a little sloppy because I'm just trying to hurry up and get the idea down so
right.
he can sing. So this one particular song we did called Believe That for Keith Washington. I took it home, cleaned up all the stuff, got it, you know, found the perfect drum sounds, got it how I wanted it,
mm-hmm.
brought it back and played it for him. He's like, yeah, man, that sounds good, man. Put it back how it was.
Really?
And his and so, you know, his whole thing was like, you perfected all of the emotion out of it.
Oh, okay.
You made it too perfect.
Right.
You know, so, you know, put it back how it was because I felt you before.
Right.
Now it just sounds like Muzak because you made it perfect.
Wow.
And so, you know, it sounds like, you know, elevator music. And he's like, man, put it back how it was. And so that was the first time I got that lesson.
Really?
And the second time, no, that was the second time. The first time, I was on my way downtown
uh-huh.
to put overdubs on a song called School Me on the
okay.
first Gerald LaVert
yeah.
album. And the song came on the radio. I said, how could that happen? So I called him and I said, hey man, I just heard School Me on the radio. He said, yeah, man, it sounded good, didn't it? I said, I still had overdubs to put on that song. He said, put them in the next one. That one is done.
Wow.
And so, you know, he was a person that you know, when he knew he had it, he wasn't gonna just keep perfecting and perfecting. You know, if he felt the song,
it was good,
like,
enough for him.
That's good enough. You know, you don't need to keep perfecting it to the point where people can't feel it.
Wow.
Now, those were two different episodes of the same message.
Right.
But working with Gerald, it was another person that taught me a lesson that stayed with me to this day.
Okay.
Anita Baker asked us for some songs.
Wow, okay. I got to hear about
so,
this.
So I sent, we wrote three songs that, man, they were tailor-made for
right.
Anita Baker.
Right.
I mean, and she called me up and she said, Tony, I really like these three songs. She said, they sound just like me. She said, they sound too much like me. She said, I wanted you to do what you do. Where's
wow.
ABC 123? You know, where's, you know, she named these, you know, five or six songs that I did. She said, I wanted you to do you. I didn't want you to mimic me. She said, I could have wrote these. And I didn't realize I had a voice at that point. I didn't realize I had a sound.
Right.
And so that was when I realized, stop trying to mimic folks. Just do what you do. They called you because they know
like
what you do.
Right.
And they appreciate what you do. So do what you do.
Wow. Good lesson.
Yes, sir.
Good lesson. Do what you do.
Now I just do what I do. I'm not trying to be the 22-year-old.
Right.
I know what I do, and I do what I do, you know, and so
do
they can't
well.
Do what I do.
Yeah.
So I stay in my lane, and I steadfastly stick to what I do, and when the phone rings, it's because somebody knows what that is, and that's what they want.
Wow.
You know, they're not asking me to sound like Pharrell.
Right.
They don't want that because they can call him for that.
Exactly.
So I do what I do.
Good lesson. That's a really good lesson. Now let me ask you, this is also a really good question. I hadn't thought about it. Like I said, I had to do some homework on you because you work with a lot of people. And there's one guy you work with in particular that I'm just curious. And this is just a fan of me. So you got to excuse this, people. I know you got to keep it professional. But it's my show, so we're going to do it how we do it. You work with Teddy Pendergrass?
Yes, sir. Wow.
I'm going to go there. So what song did you do with Teddy Pendergrass, and how was that experience working with Teddy Pendergrass? Because I just got to know.
It was a song called Voodoo.
Okay.
And the song was something that, you know, Teddy by then, obviously, he was a little incapacitated. He was in a wheelchair by then.
Right.
And I remember him trying to get out of that chair, trying to sing that song like Gerald. Like, literally, he was, I mean, you had to be there to see it. He was, I mean, reaching for the notes. He was so enamored with what Gerald did that this guy was like trying to climb out of the chair to sing the way Gerald did. And wow. It was a blessing, but it also was a humbling experience, because just like you were trying to give me accolades when I got here.
Right.
I was a huge fan of Teddy Pendergrass.
Right.
And here he is trying to get with us.
Right.
Here he is trying to say, man, I like what you guys do. I'm trying to do what you're doing.
Right.
Everybody has a voice. And if you stay true to your voice,
definitely,
everybody will have a voice. And so it's weird because your day is coming. Mark my words.
Oh, I believe.
You're going to be working with somebody that you consider a fan, and you're going to find out they're a fan of you.
Yeah, I believe it.
And, you know, when a person that, like Teddy Pendergrass, I walk in the room and I'm talking to him, and he's telling me every record I'd made to that point. And it's like, how do you know that? And why did you care? You're Teddy Pendergrass.
Right. That's, you're right.
That was like really crazy to me that would happen. So that was really, really a humbling experience. And it just underscored what I believe, that we all here to do what we do. And there's no levels.
Right.
I mean, I appreciate that you appreciate what I've done.
Right.
But I don't see myself on a different level than you.
That's a lesson that I'm learning even now. I mean, I've learned it, and I always feel like you can always continuously learn the same lesson because it makes you better. But staying humble. And my dad always preached me that. Stay humble, stay humble, stay humble. No matter how much people clap for you, give you accolades, give you awards, do all these things for you, remain humble.
Let me tell you something. My wife always says, I think you're one of the most humble guys I ever met. And I say to her, I don't even know that I could take that credit, because that's like me saying, hey, man, great bottle of water you came up with here.
Right.
Well, you didn't do it.
Right.
The Aquafina people did that.
Exactly.
So how can it be humble if I'm saying I didn't do it?
Right.
It's like, is it humble for me to admit that I didn't make it happen? The man upstairs made it happen.
Right.
So it would almost be like me taking credit for something that I don't deserve to take credit for.
That's awesome.
What I can take credit for is attempting to be obedient. I can take credit for that.
Right.
But everything on top of that was just probably reward for trying to be obedient.
Exactly.
I ain't do it.
Hey. Hey.
So I can't take credit. So I don't even know if that's humble. It's just I didn't do it.
Hey, you schooling me right now. I'm enjoying this. This is, and for all you listeners, I know you will enjoy this, because this is lessons, no matter how big you think you want to be or you would like to be. Like he said, there's no levels. And when you remember that, I really believe God just continuously blesses you, because you're able to be used to be a vessel to whoever you come in contact with.
Yes, sir.
So that's awesome. That's awesome. Wow. I don't think I've ever been stumped like this before. I'm having a great time. You know what I'm saying? I usually have great times with my interviews. And by the way, folks, we got the architect in the building. But this has just been such a great lesson for me, because before I got here, my wife told me something, and I was just about to call you to check and see if the time was, and you called me. And so when I got the phone with you, she was like, you never know. And I said, about what? She was like, think about all the things that's been happening for you, and you meeting somebody that's, you want to get in their field. And I said, yeah, that's true. She's like, you just don't know. He might like something you got. Mm-hmm. And she's like, you just don't know. So you thank God for that, because I guess for me, for a long time, I was out of position. I was trying to do it myself. I felt like I didn't need God to do it. I wasn't trying to acknowledge him. And I was just, like I said, just going to go about it and do what I got to do. Mm-hmm. And hustle and whatever or not. But I thank God for putting her in my life. And like I said, putting an architect in my life, to, you know, to help keep me straight. Because since I've been, you know, got my life in order and got back with Christ, and it's a lot of things have picked up so fast, you know what I'm saying? And going from a guy that, you know, not 2 years ago, I was mourning the loss of my son, but 2 years later, I'm here sitting here with you doing a radio show. I didn't see this happening, you know what I'm saying? And not knowing that I have a a family member who knew you. You know, he was, I mean, he found out I did the show from an interview I did with Prentice Powell, who does spoken word, and he's been on Arsenio Hall show. And he called me and said, dude, I didn't know you were doing this. I said, well, yeah, I kind of told you. He said, no, I didn't know. I was so impressed by your interview. What do you need me to do? I said, you know anybody? I mean, it helped to have contacts. And he gave me your name and he gave me a couple of the numbers. And I was like, wow. And just talking with you the first time and talking with other people, it's been a humbling experience for me. So that's having a ball. Because I'm sitting in the chair, you know, with some guy that's just been a lot of places, but yet still humble. And in the Cleveland zone, that's another thing. That's so dope. So, let's see. I want to do something fun. I want to do something really, really, really fun. So I want to ask you a couple questions that's kind of funny, but they're kind of, I've been playing around with this idea a lot for my show. If there's anybody that you have not worked with that you would like to work with, who are those artists? And let's see. Yeah, that's one question. We'll leave it right at that one because I got another question for you.
Well, anybody? I got a soft spot for the legends.
Okay.
So,
okay.
So for me, it would be Chaka Khan.
Chaka.
It would be, oh, yeah. You know, who actually I spoke to recently and we actually talked about possibly, you know, doing something in the near future.
Oh, yeah.
But I would love to produce Chaka. I would love to produce Aretha Franklin. I mean, those are the kind of folks that, you know, a Gladys Knight.
Oh, Gladys, you know, yeah.
Those legends like that, I would love to do. And I actually had some chances to do some that I didn't get around to. Luckily, I was able to do, you know, Barry White and Patti LaBelle and those kinds of stuff. Those kinds of projects mean a lot to me.
Right.
Because those are the people that I was listening to when I came into, when I was a little kid saying, wow, you know, I would love to work for them. So, you know, even producing the OJs. I mean,
right.
You know, I almost had an OJs gig when I was 15, but they found out I was 15. So that didn't work out. But to be working with the OJs now, and I'm working with, in Eddie LaVert's solo band as well. And
okay.
I'm working on some studio things with Walter Williams and,
cool.
You know, and Eddie. I've done some things with, Eric Nolan Grant here in town. And I'm sure if you haven't interviewed, you should.
I'm definitely going
to
grab him.
Great guy, interesting person to talk to.
I bet.
But for me, it's the first, I want to do the legends. And then there's a plethora of young kids that I would love to deal with, but the legends first.
I was hoping you was gonna go with the young kids first, but I see you did the legends, which is cool. Okay, since you went there, let me just throw this question. Does Patty keep a bottle of hot sauce in her purse for real on every occasion? I just gotta know. Does she pull out a bottle of hot sauce? Because every time I've seen her, she pulls this bottle of hot sauce out.
Yes. She's a heck of a cook, buddy.
I believe it.
Man, you know, the sessions I had with her, she always brought food from home,
home
cooked stuff.
Oh,
and my goodness, she's a, you know, she can do her thing.
I believe it.
That's something that she makes the sessions memorable from that standpoint.
I bet she do.
Now, I'll tell you this. On the flip side, I was at the Trump Towers in New York.
Okay.
I went down to the lobby and I said, something sure smells like chitlins, man, but I know there can't be any chitlins here in the lobby of the Trump Towers in New York.
Right.
And there were two young ladies sitting there and they had a big bag and I said, what you got in the bag?
Right.
And they said, we got some chitlins in the bag. And I said, well, just out of curiosity, why are you sitting here in the lobby? And they said, well, you know, we're waiting for our auntie, Miss Aretha Franklin. You know, she's not answering the phone. So they were bringing her some chitlins.
So I guess that's what we got to do to get Aretha.
That's what
we got some folks that can make some chitlins.
Well, you may wanna try your hand.
Wow.
Yes, sir.
Real quick before we move on, this is the architect. I just had to say, because he made mention of he's taking notes. This is officially turned from an interview into my digital notebook. So I'm just keep going back through this and just picking up stuff. Okay. It's just been amazing absorbing knowledge. But back to your interview. Then I just want to throw that in there.
Hey, so. Okay, so let's see. It was another fun question. You said there was a plethora of young artists you want to work with. Is there one in particular that you kind of like, every time you hear their name or someone, they just on you like, you know what? I really got to get with them. Is there one artist like that?
I don't know if she's... yeah, I like that Kiki Wyatt, man. Something about her voice that I just like. And at some point, I'm going to work with her.
She makes me melt.
I just like her voice.
I love her voice.
Something about it. You know, something about it. And you know what? Believe it or not, this is going to surprise you. There's something about Bruno Mars that I like. And it's not because he's a fantastic singer. If you're listening, I'm sorry, Bruno. But but I really like your voice because it's believable.
Classic. It is.
It's believable.
Yeah,
in much the same way that Mary J. Blige is believable. You believe her. Maybe she isn't from a technical standpoint, maybe she can't do the things that some of the other folks can do, but she makes you believe
she
her.
She do.
And when you sing, I had this conversation with an artist of mine recently. When you sing, you're trying to convey a message.
Exactly.
And she really effectively does that.
Wow.
She conveys the message. When you listen to Mary J.,
she do.
You believe her.
She do.
And so, you know, you can't hate on her because she gets the job done.
And she's gotten, and to me, she's an artist that has gotten better.
Absolutely.
You know, some artists kind of regress a little bit. Mary has gotten better and better and better. She's going uphill. Like, it's...
Absolutely.
I'm impressed with Mary.
Without sacrificing her ability to make you believe her.
Exactly. She's fabricating a story, and that's a very important thing that me and an architect talk about. When you're doing music, you it's got to be believable. They got to get your emotion of it.
Yes, sir.
Wow, that's dope. Kiki Wyatt. I love Kiki Wyatt.
It's just something about her voice,
it is.
Man.
Kiki Wyatt is one of the people that I feel like she can do something in one take, and you'll be like, don't do nothing else. Have you ever worked with a Vine?
Not so much.
Really?
I've met him. He's actually from Cleveland.
Yeah.
I haven't. Maybe one day I will, but I definitely, want that Kiki Wyatt.
I ain't mad at that. Like I said, she make me melt, man. I don't know too many singers that make me melt.
Because she has the technical thing, and she's believable.
She is. She put her whole heart and soul in songs. You see it, you hear it, and it's like, wow, she's dope. She's dope. Wow. And, okay, so we got into the singer side, and I just got to ask this. Any lyricists or rappers you ever wanted to work with?
Well, I can't say that there's anybody that sticks out. There's a guy in town named Just Mike.
Okay.
That I really like.
Really?
But my only issue with some of the rap stuff is that it goes back to what I initially said, where some
standard.
Of the subject matter, I can't go there.
Right.
And it doesn't mean that I'm hating on them going there.
Right.
I just can't go
You
there.
Can't go there. Right.
As a matter of fact, I had a rap act signed to a label of mine in the early 2000s. And because of that, at some point, I made the decision to just tell them to come pick their CDs up, and I was going to have to, you know, part ways, because I thought about, would I want my kids listening to this? And
exactly.
The answer was no. And so I said, I can't do it anymore. And I haven't done that music. So from that point forward, I've tried to do stuff that I wouldn't mind my kids hearing.
That is dope.
Real quick, I got another question here. Turn my mic on. I keep hearing you say, talking about singers being technical. Now, I want you to explain to the listeners what that means to be technical, because a lot of people think I have a pretty voice, sounds good. I can run better than anybody else. I can run up and down the scale like crazy, but don't understand why it doesn't translate to a listening audience. So explain to the listeners a little more what technical means.
Well, when I say technical, part of it is what you just touched on. I'm talking about a person that is, you know, more often than not, very much in tune, not mm-hmm. sharp or flat. When they sing runs, the runs are very precise. All of that, just the ability to sing, the technical aspect of singing, that we all aspire to, because music has a lot of that in it nowadays, but sometimes that's not emotional. And there are some singers out there who tend to, well, let's put it this way. I heard a quote one time that said, intelligence, like wealth, eventually demands to be displayed. So what that means is that whatever you have, eventually you're going to want to flaunt it.
Right.
So a person that has the ability to do the runs, they're going to do that, even if the song isn't calling for that,
right.
Because they know how to do that and they want you to know, in much the same way that a guy with muscles may wear a wife beater because he wants you to see. I'm not going to wear one.
Right, exactly.
There's nothing to see here. But
right.
I mean, so I'll tell you, George Duke told me that the hardest thing after learning how to play was learning when not to play.
Right.
The folks with the technical side sometimes tends to rely on that because that's the tool that they have in their tool bag.
Right.
As opposed to relying on me just believing you. And that's maybe a hard thing to learn. Maybe Mary J. Blige is believable because she's autobiographical.
Right.
She's singing stuff that's real for her. And
right.
Maybe that's why she's believable. But the technical thing doesn't necessarily move people. It will make musicians say ooh and ah, mm-hmm. but people don't always feel it. I think that's been a struggle to some extent for Layla Hathaway.
Yeah.
You know, because her voice is just like butter.
It is.
But you don't feel any struggle in it.
Yeah. Right.
And so it might not move a person the way someone's voice does, that you can hear some kind of struggle in that voice.
Yeah.
So the technical is just the having the breathing down, having the intonation down, and being able to sing runs very precisely doesn't necessarily move people.
It's
but
true.
It's nice to be able to do.
Good deal.
Yeah, that's... And it's funny you say that about Layla, because I've been a fan of hers.
Me too.
Since, let's see, I was in ninth grade. I don't know what grade I was in. But she had her first song, Baby, Baby, Don't Cry. I loved
Angela
it.
Wimbush wrote
I
that.
Loved it. And so I was, like I said, a fan, but I always wondered. I said, man, she doesn't really, you know, you hear it, but then you don't. It's like you kind of believe some of the stuff, but you don't believe all of it. But I say that to say, she recently did something with Kirk Whalum, and I'm a huge fan of his.
Mm-hmm.
And it was It's What I Do. It's called a song called It's What I Do. And she mm-hmm. won a Grammy Award for it. And I believed every word of that song.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, wow. And so it's funny. I was talking to somebody about being believable and making a song yours to the point where you like, wow, did they go through that?
Mm-hmm.
Wow. I want to ask them about, like, what were you thinking when you made that? Because, and they'll tell you, well, I didn't really make it, but it's like, you made that song so believable.
Gerald was good at that.
Very, very.
He was good at that.
I'm going to tell you why. I'm going to tell you the song. It's kind of funny. That's the song. It's kind of funny.
Yeah.
I love that song. Cause I could relate to that song. I didn't like the video for it, but
it's
I love
weird.
Yeah, that we ain't gonna talk about it. I ain't never gonna see somebody call somebody under the water.
Right.
But I love that song because I'm like, wow. I was thinking about that, and somebody was asking me, like, I guess I was looking for the song.
Yeah.
And they were like, well, we noticed. I'm like, yeah, but it's like, out of all the songs, that one. I said, yeah, cause I could relate to that one.
Yeah.
I definitely, I'm like, and I'm pretty sure a lot of guys can relate to that.
And that's the music that moves you, music that
it
you can
does.
Relate to.
Yes.
But while you're there, I'm going to tell you a trivia thing that most people don't realize.
Okay.
Gerald, on purpose, had a song about the phone on every album.
That is so funny. On purpose, you said?
On purpose. It became our thing. Like, we got to have some kind of phone song on every album, because
Stop
it came
it.
Sort of like a Lucky Charm kind of, you know, in a joking
yeah,
kind
in
of
a
way,
joking
you know?
Way.
Because the first single was Can't Give You My Private Line.
Like,
you be calling me all the time.
Right.
Real Gold would have been fine. Now I got to give you my service line. You know, and then the second album, you know, I love you. Hope you get this message. I don't deserve this. Talking to your answering service.
Pick up
the phone and call me up. You know, then you and then you name the one funny, and it's funny you should call today. But if you go back through the albums, there's some
song
that makes a reference to the phone on every album.
That is interesting. Wow. I didn't know that.
That's a little sort of inside joke that we had.
I love it. I love it. Yeah. That's that's funny. Wow. This has been fun and real. Once again, this is I'm Just Saying with my homie Tony. I'm telling you, I'm calling you Tony from now on. So if that's I call you, I'm like, Tony, you told me to call you Tony. I'm calling you Tony from now on.
And that's what's up.
Cleveland Zone, Tony, and I'm also with the architect on the side, watching over the boards and whatnot and chiming in. Let's see. I got a couple more questions, but I don't like to do the casual interviews. I like to just have conversations. So this is more like a conversation for me.
I feel it.
So, me being who I am, they call me I'm Just Saying because every time I say something, I'm always like, I'm just saying. I mean, it's like I'm just stating the obvious. So I do this with all my guests. Somehow, some way, I try to plug myself. So I would say I'm a young, and I'm gonna say I'm young because I'm not saying that you're old. I'm a young.
My son already said it. Don't worry about it. An old man named Daddy.
Hey man, you're right. He got me with that one. I gotta try that one. I'm a young producer that's learning the craft, and I would like to get in the studio with you and to maybe pick up some things or learn some stuff. Is there a chance? What would I have to do to do that? Yeah, I'm using my show for my gain. I'm sorry. Bless
the Lord.
You'd
have to call me.
No problem.
I mean, you have my number.
I'm definitely going to call.
Because I'm looking for that. I mean, I believe that all people should. You should study as many different kinds of music as you can and study as many people as you can.
I agree.
You know, in college, I was forced to study opera. And I was like, what will I ever do with this?
Man, yeah.
Listen to some of the songs that I've worked on with Gerald and some of those beginnings, like the Taking Everything and all of that stuff. It's all opera influenced.
Wow.
And not only just that, after studying classical music, mm-hmm. when I sat down to do string arrangements, I knew what I was looking for.
Right.
And I wouldn't have known that
if I hadn't
studied that. Now, my dad was a huge big band fan growing up. I didn't listen to a lot of R&B growing up.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I heard Al Green, I heard Aretha Franklin, and eventually when I started picking my own music, I was a huge Earth, Wind & Fire fan.
Oh, yeah.
But a lot of R&B I did not consume growing up. I heard gospel from my mom, and I heard jazz from my father.
Oh, that's a beautiful combination.
So, that's what I heard. But because of that, when I started working on records and I wanted to do horn arrangements, I knew what a horn arrangement should sound like.
Right.
Because I had all of that big band music in my repertoire just from music that I'd studied. That does scare me about nowadays.
Really?
And what I'm saying is that the kids, they have a way of consuming only the music that they already like and the music that they already know.
Right.
I didn't have that option when I was a kid. I was forced to consume music that I might not have chosen, but made me richer down the road.
Yeah.
Our kids don't necessarily have that because they're able to put the headphones on and basically be in their own world.
Exactly.
So they don't get exposed to the variety of things that they could if they were forced to hear my music.
Right. That's cool. I agree.
So I take every chance I can.
Hey, I understand. And it's funny because there was a point in time where I was in the Coltrane, John Coltrane. I didn't even know it because my uncle listened to a lot of jazz.
Mm-hmm.
And I just enjoyed it because it seemed like it just made me want to float. I don't know what it is about. It as a child, it was like so soothing.
Mm-hmm.
And so I remember those. So when I hear people like, oh, you know, what you know about Coltrane? I'm like, I was listening when I was like 6, 7, yeah. 8. I didn't know what it was, but I enjoyed it. And so I went and what I did maybe for about 4 months, I went into library. And I tell people all the time, the library is one of the best places to go to really do research on music. They have, like you said, classical, opera, gospel, big band, blues, all them things at your disposal. And if they don't have it, they are more likely to get it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went and got a Miles Davis, quite a few of just a lot of older guys just listening to how they played and what they did and the arrangements. Then when they all played together, you know, I'm even a huge Herbie Hancock fan.
That's my favorite artist of all times.
Oh, Herbie. Hancock. Herbie is dope, man.
That is my most favorite artist of all times.
Really?
Yes, sir.
That's good to know.
He is my favorite.
I loved him. I didn't realize how far back he had been doing. And a lot of the things that I liked that I didn't know the name of, he did it.
He was playing for Miles Davis when he was a teenager.
Right. Didn't know that. Did not know that.
Started out with the big band stuff, doing his thing. And he along with Miles Davis, changed music.
Yeah.
And, you know, as a matter of fact, I think it's in Miles Davis's book where he was at the first inauguration of George Bush, the first George Bush.
Yeah.
And Barbara Bush happened to ask him, "And what did you do to be here today?" Because she didn't know who he was.
Wow.
And I think he said something about, "I changed music 4 or 5 times." Like, literally changed the music. Even though the historians credit him with changing music 5 or 6 times. But he said, "I changed music 4 or 5 times. You know, and other than marry the right man, what did you do to be here today?"
Oh. Oh, 2 thumbs up. 2 thumbs up.
Miles Davis.
Miles Davis.
Now, when I lived in Columbus before I moved to Cleveland, my songwriting partner at the time, I left Columbus to come to Cleveland to work with Gerald, and he left to go play with Miles Davis.
Really?
His first big gig. Yeah, he went straight from, you know, us fooling around, you know, in a home studio to playing for Miles Davis. He is now playing lead bass, you know. And the funny part is he got his lesson, too. He went and bought every album Miles Davis had done at that point and learned every song on every album.
That's what you got to do.
And when he got there, Miles said, "Man, I don't want to play none of that, man. I made that music. I did that. I'm trying to do the new stuff."
Wow, that's funny.
It's funny that it worked out that way, but I still believe that he should have done that.
Yeah, you know, he did his homework.
Because if you play for an artist, you're supposed to be the Bible of what they are.
That's true.
You know, he had to go do his homework, but it's funny. And he's such a versatile musician. He is now the drummer for Parliament Funkadelic.
Get out of here.
I kid you not. Yes, sir.
I'm sorry. I'm about to go. Earth, Wind & Fire, Parliament Funkadelic. Cheek.
Yes, sir.
I kind of raised myself on that. Those are people I gravitated to as a youngster. And I didn't know why. You know, everybody was more towards the R&B and the hip hop. I kind of just stayed there because there was so much to learn from there. Then on top of that, all the stuff that everybody was listening to came from that.
Came from there anyway. My son and I do a game like that. You know, where did that come from?
Yeah.
So we listen to a lot of current music today, and then I'll go have the original song
and go put it on. Yeah.
This is where they got that from.
Right.
He's amazed every time.
I bet. But that's a good lesson though for kids that want to be in music.
Absolutely.
Or anybody wants to be in music, so they can not go in naive. Because I've heard artists and younger musicians and even athletes, when you ask them about the past, they have not a clue about any of the things that they're listening to or have done, or people that have gone before them have done. And
they
I'm kind of surprised. Yeah. I thought maybe that was kind of part of the unwritten rule of at least studying some of your craft.
It should be. But it's not, because we're in the music industry.
Right.
And if you were a doctor,
right,
you would have to go to school. You would have to do a residency. You would have to be board certified.
Right.
See, all of these things prove that you are who you say you are.
Exactly.
If you're a musician or a producer or a songwriter, all you got to do is go get a card made.
That's true.
Get a card made.
Now, I got a question. I'm glad we talked about bringing up old music into the new music, and it's been going on like that forever. And I'm kind of like you when I talk to different people about music or whatever, and they're like, "Oh, this producer's bad, he did this and did that." I'm like, "He just sampled all the Keith Sweat album and put it on here." Like, you don't know that. So but I say that to ask this. in the sampling era that we're in, where you could just take a nice track that somebody put their time, effort, blood, sweat, and tears in and mastered it, and you put a little loop and spin on it and some 808s over the top of it, do you think that's helping or hurting artists be able to grow and become the next Miles Davis or whoever you want them to be?
Both. And that sounds like an ambiguous answer, but mm-hmm. I'll have to explain it. Mm-hmm. It does take a certain amount of cleverness to do that.
Right.
Whether that's musicianship is debatable. It's not everybody can do it, so it obviously requires some level of ability.
Right.
It's just the only thing that's in debate is whether that's musical or not.
Right.
Innovation is going to happen. And every time something new comes into this industry, it's overdone for a period. And then we calm down. You know, when drum machines came, I mean, let's go all the way back. I'm going to take it back historically.
Okay.
Back in the day when the microphone was invented,
right,
that ushered in the era of the crooner.
Okay.
Now, back then, you had to be able to belt to sing.
Right.
Because there weren't microphones. And so once the microphone was invented, everybody thought that now everybody's just going to croon, because now you can just sing softly on the mic and you can, you know, and it did usher in an era of a lot of music like that, that, you know, that was sung that way, more from a crooning kind of standpoint. When auto-tune came, everybody thought, you know, nobody would be able to sing anymore.
Yeah.
It would just be folks that are auto-tuned. When drum machines came, everybody thought drummers were going to be obsolete. When keyboard bass came, everybody thought bass players were going to go out of style. I mean, there's always, when keyboards came, everybody thought pianos would go away.
Right.
There's always an innovation that's going to be overdone for a period. And then everybody comes back to their senses and we get back to doing what we're doing. And then that just becomes a particular tool that can be used, but it doesn't become the tool. You know, just like there's a lot of sampling going on, there's a lot of good music happening out there right now, too, that people are really playing. There's really a movement towards playing music again.
Right.
And so, you know, it'll never take over. It's never going to be that. Because there's too many musicians out there that still want to play.
Right. I agree. That's dope. I'm enjoying myself. This is like history 101. You know what I'm saying?
I kind of tend to get historical with it just because I think that
it's needed.
Yeah. And a lot of times there's a lot of events that lead up to where we are right now. You know, what led up to the sampling and all of that kind of stuff? There's a whole bunch of things that are probably contributing factors to that. The first one of which, 1980, Ronald Reagan took a lot of money out of the schools trying to balance the budget.
Right.
A lot of school music programs got cut.
Right.
Okay. So that was in 1980. 1979, the first major rap song hits the airwaves. You know, that was Sugar Hill Gang.
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, that happened. And so now you're starting to get a generation of kids who like rap, but they don't have the school musical training.
That's true. You're right.
And so you, if you fast forward a decade later, you start getting a lot of atonal rap music where, you know, they have these samples that are put together all in different keys and all of that kind of stuff because they don't know any better. So that becomes a voice in and of itself.
That's true.
Now add to that, in 1981 or so, MTV comes along.
Right.
And now, what does that have to do with anything? That ushered in the era of the producer. Because before that, people didn't really know the producers.
Sure didn't.
You know, but so the record labels got bright and they start saying, well, hey, man, now that music is visual, if we can just make the artist look good, they don't have to really have the goods. We'll hire a producer to make that happen.
Exactly.
So then, a year, you know, 10 years later into that, then you see the Teddy Rileys and, you know, what have you. Now the era of the producer gets ushered in to the point where it got to the point where there was a Milli Vanilli, you know, and so that was taken to the extreme. That was the extreme, and then it started to pull back. So they were giving producers crazy money. As a matter of fact, I got in on like the last tail end of that era where, as a producer, your name could get you major budgets without even turning in a record.
Oh, that's beautiful. That was beautiful. Yeah.
You know, and there was a lot of folks that made a, you know, made a name for themselves and a lot of money, you know, during that period. And a lot of them are gone now.
Yeah.
You know, the ones that have lasted are like the Jimmy Jams and Terry Lewis's of the world.
Definitely.
You know, and Jimmy Jam actually said to me one time, he said, "I don't ever want to be hot. I want to be consistently warm." And that's what they've done. They've lasted the storm, and they're still doing great work to this day.
They are. I gotta give it to them. They're dope.
But that's where, you know, if you start looking at the historical stuff, then you understand where some of these things came from.
Right.
And that's why we got a lot of bad music in the '80s. You know, just because they weren't real artists. Even LaVert was affected by that. LaVert was affected because LaVert was a band.
Right.
In much the same way in the '70s model that a Cameo or somebody would have been.
Yeah, because they played. They all were playing. Yeah. Yeah.
I think they looked at themselves as that kind of band. But when they got their record deal, Atlantic said, "We'll sign three of you guys. Which three you want it to be?
Wow.
The rest of you will be sidemen." And it became Mark Gordon, Sean LaVert, and Joe LaVert.
Right.
And they were the three up front guys, and everybody else became sidemen.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Wow.
That was the attitude in the
80s. That was, I have to say, because it was some bad music in the 80s. I will never forget that.
And what further ushered, you know, what further facilitated the rap era in the 90s was in 1993, January, they went to SoundScan.
Yes.
Now, before that, radio stations and record stores reported their top 40. When they went to SoundScan, and before that, if you remember, I don't know if you're old enough, but if you remember back then, the ZAK used to advertise, "We play no rap."
They sure did. They made it known.
Rap and country were not respected by the industry.
They wasn't.
But when SoundScan came, and the guys in the suits started realizing how much money they were making, 4 years later, you have a Garth Brooks.
Yeah.
You know, who's a country megastar. You know, the top 10 pop went to rap the first week that they, you know, a couple of the top, you know, the number one song was a rap song, you know, on the pop charts that weren't on the charts the week before at all, anywhere.
Once they let them in, that was it.
And so that's what happened. And so so we went from radio stations saying we play no rap to 3 years later, they weren't playing any R&B.
That, you know what?
That's true. What happened.
And I remember that because I remember one of the men at large, Dave Tolliver.
Mm-hmm.
He, when they was doing the Rappers Delight show and all that, I remember that it was like, yo, I was like, you guys remember? Because I had to, like, I sat there and I was joking. I remember just riding home listening to ZAK and I'm like, you remember they used to play rap? Mm-hmm. But then they didn't used to play rap.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, and so it's kind of funny. It's like, but like you said, they always go back to what is the basis of the thing. And so that's pretty interesting. I'm liking that.
Well, there's a reason for that too, because I'm historical, like I told you.
Okay.
So in 96, radio got deregulated.
Yeah.
And what that meant is people could own, you know, more than one station in an area.
Right.
And so at that time, 107.9 and 93 competed against each other.
I remember that. I definitely remember that.
Once they were all bought out by Radio 1, then that meant that they weren't going to compete with each other anymore, because I'm not going to compete with myself. So I'm going to make this, you know, an oldies and conventional R&B station, and I'm going to make this the urban and hip-hop station.
Right.
You know, so that's how all of that came about. Yeah. It was the deregulation of radio in 96 by, I think, Bill Clinton.
Bill Clinton, yeah. Yeah, that was Bill Clinton.
I just got to ask. I've been debating back and forth. You ever thought about teaching? Because, I mean, the level of knowledge that you have. Because, you know, it's one thing, you know, obviously you're in a different league than where we are, where we're trying to get to. But the level of information that you have is like, I'm either saying to myself, wow, that's good information, or most people don't know this stuff that he knows. Like we know because we intentionally research, but it's like, you ask the average other musician, producer, or whatever, they have no clue about regulating radio stations and, you know, how this station was bought out to by a certain company, and this is why this sounds like this and that sounds like that. Or even with, they have a AM 1300 now. It was 1490 right. first, and then they changed to 1300. They bought out the gospel station and rebranded that. Like, most people don't know this stuff. Like, you ever thought about putting this in a college course for people to learn? Because I think it would amplify.
Or even a high school course.
Or that too, if they had the proper budget.
Never crossed my mind. Most of it, I lived through it. That's right. why I remember. Yeah. Some of it is, I remember having records that fell off the charts in 1993 when SoundScan came, because a lot of R&B artists, you know, they were on the charts because of hype.
Right.
You know, they bought those positions, and when Truth came in, those records fell off, or at least out of the top 40, I will say that.
Right.
You know, so I remember, you know, radio being deregulated. I was trying to buy a radio station at the time. So, I mean, it's like a lot of this stuff, I've just lived through it. It's not even that I actually thought about it.
Right.
I lived through that stuff. If someone wants me to teach, I will, but it hadn't crossed my mind.
Gotcha. Yeah, that's amazing. Now, let me ask you a question. I know you work with a lot of R&B artists, and you said you work with some faith-based artists. Which genre is funner for you, or are they all just fun?
I would have to say they're both fun for me, because the secular stuff, I'm only going to go so far.
Right.
So I'm not in a position where I feel like I'm compromising to do it.
Right.
You know, the faith-based stuff in some ways I think is more of a challenge.
Really?
And it's more of a challenge because I think it's more of a challenge to try to walk the line between sounding like it's current,
right,
and not going too far to the point where somebody says, well, there's no God in this. This don't even sound, you know, so you have to find out where that line is. I mean, you know, folks like Mary have done a great job.
They've done a great job.
You know, but that's not easy. It's easier said than done.
Right.
You don't necessarily have those confines in, you know, straight secular R&B.
Right.
You know, so I do find the gospel part a little more of a challenge. Not a bad challenge, but more of a challenge.
It's more, you have to do kind of more of a intense research with that. I was wondering that, because I'm gonna tell you why I asked that, because I used to be an advocate for, and my mom was big on trying to get me to listen to Christian music and get me out of the rap, because I used to listen to hardcore stuff like Snoop Dogg, Dr. Dre, all that crazy stuff.
The music was good.
But that's what I was trying to tell her. I was trying to explain to her. I said, listen, you might not agree with this, but the way they're doing it is so skillful. You can't even hate on it.
No, the music was good, man.
And she tried to get me to listen to some gospel gangsters and some other stuff, and it was so garbage. It was, and I appreciate the message.
It seemed
contrived. They were trying too hard. They were trying to, it was like, they really were trying too hard, and they forgot to make the music. Mm-hmm. Like, and I'm like, dude, that's not cool. So I just thought about it, because it just made me think about a time while I was at home, and she bought me all these CDs. She took my Warren G CD. She took my Dr. Dre CD. She took all those things. She hid them, and she gave me all these CDs of these gospel Christian artists. And she had this nice, my father had this nice stereo system. And she's like, well, I'm about to run to the store. And so I was like, I knew where the stash was at. I said, so I turned it up. She said, turn it up. So I'm turning it up. She dancing with me, and I'm playing it off. I said, oh, I'm about to get her. So we dancing. And so she left. And I took that stuff off, and I put my Dr. Dre back in. I turned it all the way up, and I listened to Dre Day about four times before she came back. When I seen her pulling, I took it out, and I put the Gospel Gangsters CD back in there, and, you know, and that's, she never knew to this day that I did it.
It's funny that you say that, because back then when Christian hip hop, gospel rap, whatever they're defining it as now, first came out, and it's part of the reason why I asked the question about sampling, is that's what they did, is they'll take a song like a Biggie song and change the words, but it's just Biggie song with you putting some sort of Christian content to it. It's like, it's no identity, it's no character, and you don't have a chance to hone your own craft. Just like you're talking about with people having certain sounds and knowing how to evolve out of those sounds. You can't do that because you have no sound. You have the next hottest track sound out and you're making it its own. So now with, you know, people starting to be more comfortable in their skin and what you can, like you were saying with just traditional gospel, what you can do and what you can't do, you're starting to see more of an identity. You're starting to see people branch out and know how to deal with certain producers, certain sounds, where before it was like, okay, what top 40 song are you going to take and try to make it a Christian song? It's like, first of all, I think it's some copyright issues with that, so you're never getting known. But secondly, it's like, you're not developing your own style. You're always going to be 20 steps behind because you're picking up on the sound that they actually probably did 2, 3, 4 years ago and just put out now.
Right.
And when you think you're doing what they're doing, they're already past that phase. So, yeah, that was an interesting stumbling block with Christian hip hop. So I'm so glad that it's evolved from there now where you can get good music and good quality sound. One person, I don't know if you're hip with him. I know you referenced Columbus or not, but it's a young artist. He's probably 27-ish. His name is Christian Gray. Just came out with an album called School of Roses.
Yeah.
My God. I was literally between his album, Even With Evil With Us in 2011 and this one coming out, I'm like, please don't box yourself in because, you know, you have to put this safe record out. And he came out with School of Roses. I'm like, yes. I'm like, this is what the people need to hear. Like, my wife's grandmother, we were going, I took her to a doctor's appointment or something like that. And she's nodding and tapping and just like, she's jamming this, but you don't realize this is Christian music. But, you know, with more skill and more substance to it, knowing that you can talk about so many different things, but still be pertaining to God and godly value. So,
yeah. Well, he touched on it first. You have to make it music first.
Yeah.
Because it is music first. So if the music isn't good, you've lost them on the message.
Exactly.
You know, you gotta make an uncompromisingly good piece of music first.
Right.
If that's the genre.
Right, right.
I mean, you know, if you're writing a love song, then maybe the accompaniment doesn't matter as much.
Yeah.
But if you're gonna compete in that world, the music has to be bar none. It has to be.
Yeah.
Then they might listen to the message.
Exactly. Yeah.
That's true.
Well, I have no choice because you done put the song on repeat 20 times. So now you got to hear what they're saying. So, get that.
Right. Yeah. Thanks. Man. I got to say, this has been fun. I've had a great time. James, you got any more questions?
Nah, I'm just dropping in little bits in here. I'll try to stay out of the way, man.
I understand. This has been very knowledgeable. I've been very humbled. I feel like I've been in school too, which is a good thing.
Sorry.
No, which is a great thing because for me, where I'm at personally, I was to the point where I thought about not even, like, I was like, you know what? I need not even do music anymore. I need to go ahead and do something else or focus more on the radio. But before the interview, I felt like going back down to the basement and work on some stuff and I'm like, man, I don't know what's up with this interview, but I didn't know what was going to come from this interview. And so for me, it just kind of, like I said, it inspired me some more. I was already inspired, but it helps. It helps when you hear from somebody who's been doing it, who's done it at a level like James said, that you want to get to, you know. And so, like I said, knowing that I'm able to call you now and be like, hey, I want to come through and just, because I've never had that. I never had somebody, and that was my issue. I never had somebody I can go and just listen to and hang with, because it's always like, why are you here? Or what are you trying to get? Or what are you? I'm like, I'm trying to learn.
I never had that either. So I know the feeling,
you know, I'm trying to learn. So it's like, you know, I've got this gift to be able to do it, to make stuff. You know, I just need to know how to craft it a certain way so that I'm able to, like you said, to maybe give it to somebody and present it in a way that they can say, hey, I like that. I like that. But like I said, it goes back to the hard work and determination. And like you said, going to work every day, Absolutely. Day, putting in the right work, you know.
But you know what? There is more. There's more than that.
I believe it.
Because I will say that in this industry, there's a huge bottleneck between the folks that create and the folks that are looking for stuff.
Right.
And the folks in one group don't know how to find the folks in the other group.
That's true.
So, you know, I've tried to, as much as I can, I've tried to be that person that connects these people. Absolutely. So, you know, maybe there are some things we can do. And you never stop honing that voice.
Right.
Because I'm here to tell you, it only takes one record.
I believe
to transform the whole thing. And now they want everything you got.
That's true.
And it's happened to me more than once. There have been times when I've been in a rebuilding period. And so I'm just writing songs, and I'm not knowing necessarily what I'm going to do with those songs.
Right.
And so then a project comes along and you need 15 songs and you need them right now.
And you got them.
You got them. And so that's something that it in the early stages, it never dawned on me to stop.
Right.
You know, because I just didn't believe that God would have me doing that for no reason.
I feel the same way, because like I said, for me to And a friend of mine told me, he was like, dude, you realize that. And he's like, I don't think you realize this. He was like, but you kind of cut off everybody. You would stop hanging with everybody and be on your board so much that nowadays people don't know. They don't know really what angle to come at you. And I'm like, what you mean? I'm still me. It's like, no, but you understand. You would like leave. I would hang with people for like 2 weeks just to hang, just to get out and be gone for 7 months. Easy. But I was working on my board, going to work, working on my board, going to work, working on my board. And that's all I did. I slept and eat it. So and, like for me now, it's like I have a family, but I'm also doing that and doing radio. So they're like, yo, wait, I'm like, well, and he told me, he was like, you've been doing this for so long. You got to know that it wasn't you. I have to agree. And so, like I said, from you saying that, like I said, it helps. And it's some words of encouragement. Mm-hmm. So I definitely appreciate it. I definitely appreciate you coming down to the station and hang with us and dropping the knowledge and just being an awesome guest. I got to say, you were an awesome guest. I've had some guests. But this right here, I'm like a little giggly little girl. Ha 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 ha. You know, just having a ball, man. Just taking all the information in. So.
Well, thanks for having me. I've had a ball, and I will be back.
Oh, thank you. Yes, oh, yeah, we definitely going to have you back.
Yes, sir.
I got your number.
Yes, sir.
You know, I'll tell anybody, when you give me your number, I'm going to use it. We got to worry about that.
That's
hey,
what's
hey,
up.
Hey, man, don't stalk him.
Look, I'm not looking for it. Don't stalk him. Hey, I promise you, look, I don't stalk nobody. I'm for future guests, I don't stalk you. But if you ignore me, I have ways of finding you.
That's what's up,
man. You know what I'm saying? Once again, people, this has been my man, Tony. I am Dom Just Saying, the architect, Shock Therapy on Culture Shock Radio. We've had a ball. It's time to go. It's the sad part. But we about to leave. Tony got to do some stuff. I got to go do some stuff. And architect, he always doing some stuff. So tune in later. I guess we'll talk to y'all later. We out. Two fingers.
Deserve.